Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. We want to begin by sharing the account of Matthew Kaufman on his recent experience in downtown Louisville protesting racial injustice. Matthew, an English teacher at Marion Moore High School in Louisville, is the 2020 Kentucky High School Teacher of the Year. I spoke with him by phone, and this is his story in his own words, offered in four parts. It begins on the evening of Friday, May 29th.
It was my first night of protest, and was after the 911 call that was released by the police from Kenneth Walker, as he was calling the police because somebody kicked down his door, he didn't know who, and shot his girlfriend, Breonna Taylor. And once we heard that, we took to the streets pretty immediately to protest and solidarity with young people and our students. I teach a wide demographic in my classroom. At my school, Marion C. Moore, we've got over 50 nationalities represented. It's a very diverse school. We take lots of pride in our diversity. We say our diversity protects us. We actually have our students march through the hallways where they create posters for like Black Lives Matter or all people are welcome here. And they have chants like more love, less hate. Our diversity makes us great. So I teach kids who have dealt with, on a daily basis, racial profiling, who have experienced firsthand police brutality, kids who have just since faced immense barriers and trauma in their lives, but still are kind and optimistic and hardworking and have so much hope to build a better world and to be that change. So my fiance and I stood with them in solidarity Friday night. We marched with thousands of protesters around the courthouse, and overwhelmingly, the crowd had the attitude of wanting our country just to live up to its values of liberty and justice for all, because our students don't experience that. We make them say the Pledge of Allegiance every single morning, and every single morning they feel the irony that they don't get that same promise of liberty and justice for all that people like myself as a privileged white male do. Friday night, I ended up in the front lines, right in between a line of SWAT. Police were in riot gear and between the protesters. And I live stream this. It's all on my Facebook for folks to see. And you see an intergenerational group made up of all races. Overwhelmingly, though, kids who are in high school and college, up to 30. And they're armed with their posters and they're armed with their cell phones and their voices. And they were chanting justice for Breonna Taylor. They were chanting no justice, no peace. I was there standing next to our House Representative Attica Scott when tear gas hit us. And that's when they started shooting us. Not quite sure what I was being shot with. But just imagine like a bunch of wasps stinging you, and that's kind of what it feels like. I was able to get to a medical station that some girls set up, and they were spraying my eyes with baking soda and water, and then police started targeting us over there, so we had to run again. They were targeting our medical stations. And then I found a black couple who poured just water all over my face, said that my eyes would stop burning and I could see, and my fiance and I fled the scene.
Matthew and his fiance returned to the protest scene in downtown Louisville on the following Sunday, May 31st.
Sunday night, we went again, and we have a mayor named Greg Fisher, who I've worked with, who supported a lot of my students in our work, as we both advocate for a more compassionate city and like an interfaith festival. And in my whole mission at school is to like use the intersection of the arts for personal and social transformation. And that's evolved as we've gotten more political in my after-school clubs to missions of ending oppression and intolerance and like breaking down institutions that are oppressive and cultural stereotypes that prevent self-actualization. But we were out, basically Greg Fisher lied about why police were destroying and stealing medical supplies and water from protesters in the day before curfew was set. And we saw videos on it, and police came up in unmarked cars and just started destroying the medical supplies and the water and taking it. And when peaceful protesters who were practicing civil disobedience went to approach and ask why, a line of SWAT stood between them. Mayor Fisher then said that there was like jars, like mason jars filled with flammable substances and other harmful materials, but that was not there. And so he, in that moment, was scapegoating citizens who were trying to take care of the protesters. And so we were there Sunday night, and we were with the crowd. Right now there's a curfew set in Louisville at 9 p.m. But before 9 p.m., we were unable to leave Louisville. We ended up surrounded by SWAT and army on all ends. We were with a large group of protesters, about 1,000 people or so. At that point in the night, the protesters, again, overwhelmingly young people, were not in the streets as much as they were on the sidewalks. But we kept getting boxed in. And then they started tear gassing us and shooting us and throwing, these pellet grenades at us. And then a large group of over 1,000 was split up in multiple factions. And at that point, we just kept getting split up more and more and more. They were dividing us. And then we ended up getting boxed in. And my fiance and I, and a past student of mine who was with me, Ariana Tule, were arrested. We did not resist arrest. Our hands were up in the air. They threw us down to the floor, pressed our faces into the cement, yelling at us, that tied our hands. My fiance's wrists were bleeding. They zip tied them so tight. I'll tell you, we were all doing the exact same thing. I was charged with an unspecified misdemeanor. My black female student, who was right with me, received 3 charges, all misdemeanors. We're doing the exact same thing.
Matthew, his fiance, and his former student were loaded into a van and taken to be booked and jailed.
I ended up in a cell with 30 of the protesters, but there were 4 cells there. 1 cell for the girls. There's about 30 of them, and then 3 cells for the men, and there was about 90 of us. We ended up forming a really tight group in our cell. We almost had class in there as we shared our stories and why we were there and what happened and what led us to this moment. And of course, all the, there were overwhelmingly young people in there. When I say young people, I'm saying 18 to 30. I am 40 years old. The vast majority were in their 20s, so like early 20s. And so these are all also JCPS graduates. And that's the district I teach in. And when I asked them why they're there, the consensus was it just has to end. It's over. And what they mean by that is the racial profiling, is the police brutality. It's how police can enter somebody's home, shoot them, and then get away with impunity and still be in our streets. And we don't know if those police officers are also out there at night in riot gear. Are they the ones also tear gassing us and shooting us right now? Overall, the attitude amongst the group I was with was really positive. I've never been arrested, and I was definitely, my eyes were open to what happens behind jail. Well, as protesters, we're a pretty darn educated bunch, so we know coronavirus is happening. We've been social distancing this whole time until Friday night. And then this is just too important for us to sit on the sidelines. I think people like myself have too much privilege in a platform not to use it, that we have to use it. One of my favorite signs I've seen out that I've seen a lot of white students create is white silence is violence. And I just think that takes so much courage to do. And when we were in jail, when we got booked, almost none of the police had masks on, which just blew me away. Police overwhelmingly, when I got there, I was very upfront with them, with who I am. As Kentucky Teacher of the Year, as a high school teacher of 13 years, and they were extremely polite with me. However, I saw them grab a young man who I was in a cell with by his neck and throw him to the ground and rough him up because he wanted to know where his backpack was. I was processed fairly quickly. There was a young nurse who took my vitals and checked me, and she was awesome. She thanked me for wearing a Black Lives Matter shirt. I asked for another mask. They gave me one. I ended up upstairs. Not everybody got a mask. Once I was upstairs, again, like almost no police were wearing masks. The jail cell we were in was really unsanitary. I ended up, I'm not quite sure what time I got to the jailhouse. I'm guessing it was around 10 o'clock. By the time they finished processing me and I was in a cell, it was 11 o'clock. Never got any offer of hand sanitizer, soap, anything like that. And so then we were all in there. None of us had our rights read to us. None of us were really told why we were arrested. But it was made evident that we were getting charged with different things for doing the same stuff. And that some of my new Black and brown friends were getting charged with felonies for doing the exact same thing I was doing, which is just marching on the streets, saying no justice, no peace, and getting trapped so we couldn't leave. Most of the people I was locked up with got boxed in before curfew and did not have a way out. We kept getting boxed in and boxed in and boxed in. And then what we realized is they're making an example out of us tonight. They want us to suffer. They want to deter us. And so some of the things we talked about there was even just how privileged of a time we were in for our jail time, as we thought about previous protesters in the civil rights movement and what they faced, with dogs being stuck on them, with real bullets being shot at them, and much, much harsher brutality. So we all had that in mind. We were thankful for that. Yeah, we were never given phone calls until like the next day in the afternoon. We were never really told, you know, what was going on. Police had zero concern about coronavirus. Zero. It was not even on their radar. They were playing mind games with us. We were told we would be released at 6:30 a.m. and that would be the earliest we could be released because that's when curfew is over. 6:30 a.m. came and went. It was 9 a.m. They said it'd be a couple hours. That came and went. Then it was 2 p.m. That came and went. Then we were told some of us might get off today. Some of us might get out tomorrow. Some of us might be in there for 3 days because they could hold us up to 72 hours under the law. I ended up getting released around 5 o'clock p.m. I was in there at 10 p.m. They never offered us water. We had to ask for it. Like my first drink of water was at 2 p.m. on Monday after getting arrested Monday night. The food they fed us in that morning, they offered us breakfast of like a dog food, like cereal and some cartons of milk. I drank the milk. They didn't offer us any spoons or anything. So again, we're forced to eat with our hands or like a dog in the era of coronavirus. Also, you know, we're being tear gassed relentlessly when we're in the middle of a respiratory pandemic. They had zero concern for coronavirus. Zero awareness that if we get infected, then we're putting the rest of the community at risk now. So my fiance and I are doing our best to stay involved, but also quarantine right now and decide to get tested so we don't put anybody else at risk.
So I asked Matthew Kaufman what he hopes to see result from this protest.
There's a list of demands that Breonna Taylor's family and Black Lives Matter put out. And those are the demands that we want. So like police body cams, they need to be turned on. We know abuse is happening. And quite frankly, I would have never... I would have never understood how bad it is unless I experienced it myself. Like even the fact that I teach these kids and I read their writings and I read their stories and I love them with my whole heart, You can't understand the kind of abuse they face until you are standing with them and it happens to you and you see it happen to them. That needs to stop. Our police should not be terrorizing and scapegoating us. They should be protecting and serving. So we need that paradigm shift to take place. And again, these kids are out there, intergenerational, interdisciplinary, intercultural, all races group, fighting for this. You know, and it's my belief America's at its best and we all link arms and march forward together. As far as other demands we want Breonna Taylor's murderers, these police officers who came in on a no-knock search warrant and just shot and killed her in her own home and then blamed Kenneth Walker and arrested him for shooting a police officer. Then we later find out it was friendly fire that hit that police officer. We want those police officers fired, and we want them to have a fair and open trial in court. There cannot be a different legal standard for police officers and the wealthy than there are for the rest of us. Ultimately, I think everyone is out there marching because we just want our country to live up to its values of liberty and justice for all. And that's not happening right now. So we want police accountability. We want police transparency. I feel hunted in the streets because I stand with Black people now. So the question I'm asking my white friends, my sphere of influence is, do you have the courage to stand with Black people? Or are we going to stay comfortable in our bubbles, in our white middle class privilege? You know, and like we've got stuff like we've got medical, my family, we've got so many medical bills. We're still paying. We're in the process of buying a new house. We're trying to save the nonprofit my fiance works at in the middle of a pandemic. I'm working on a book series with my students that they are publishing right now, the children's book series. So we are very, very busy people. But right now there are like thousands and thousands of people organizing to stay on the streets, to claim these streets, to say that like we have a right to be here. And people like me who've got this much privilege, it's my belief that it's our responsibility to be the wind at the back of these protesters and to be shields for them. What I'm disappointed in is I see so many kids, but there's not equal amount of adults my age out there who are 40 and over. Overwhelmingly, it's high school kids, it's college kids, it's young professionals who are risking their bodies out there to get this message out. And so I just want to plea that, like, for Black Lives to Matter in Louisville, it's all lives in, and we need everybody there.
Matthew Kaufman teaches English at Marion Moore High School in Louisville. He's the 2020 Kentucky High School Teacher of the Year. Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher's office did not respond to our request for a comment. Protesters have been calling for a statewide ban on no-knock warrants in Kentucky after the Louisville police raid that led to the death of Breonna Taylor. Capitol reporter Ryland Barton says state lawmakers discussed the issue in Frankfort.
Lawmakers heard testimony about Taylor's killing, racial discrimination, and the massive protests that have taken place in Louisville and across the country. Keturah Heron with the ACLU of Kentucky and Black Lives Matter said lawmakers need to start passing laws that are equal for all people.
Whether it's tax reform, whether it's in our criminal legal system, whether it's in education, we have to start doing that.
Black Lives Matter has been calling for a statewide ban on no-knock warrants and the creation of citizen review panels that would have subpoena power to investigate law enforcement. Republican leaders of the legislature say they expect they'll discuss the issues over the summer. The legislature doesn't go back into full session until January. I'm Ryland Barton in Frankfort.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah.
escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today.
Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
How does a society with such a long history of racism, racial inequity, and injustice level the playing fields and offer all of its citizens equal access to opportunity? Anthropologist and author Chris Begley takes up that question in the latest installment of our series, Future Tense.
I'm here today with Dr. Arnold Farr, professor of philosophy at the University of Kentucky. Dr. Farr deals primarily with social and political philosophy, as well as the philosophy of race. Well, welcome, Arnold.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for doing this. Now, I usually start by asking about where we are now in this pandemic. One of the things I want to talk about today, though, is the fact that almost overshadowing the pandemic are some of the other things that are going on now. The protests and the unrest because of police actions. And I wanted to ask, in light of that and in light of our situation here with the pandemic, where do we find ourselves? And does this kind of stuff articulate with the kind of work you've been doing?
It does. And I think I find us in a very bad place. I find the country in a very bad place, but it's not a surprising place. I think things we've done in the past, our history, has sort of led to this moment, and we're really in a dangerous spot. But there are possibilities. I mean, one possibility is that somehow we'll learn from our mistakes, we'll learn from the pandemic, we'll learn from the riots and the unrest, and figure out a way to move forward together. Or it's quite possible that the entire country will collapse. Americans don't like to think about that, but it has happened historically to great empires, great civilizations. They have, for some reason or another, crumbled, and quite often that destruction was from within as opposed to without. So Americans really have to think about that and make a decision about how we're going to move forward. Regarding the pandemic has actually revealed to us how bad our situation was prior to the pandemic. And think about, I mean, prior to the pandemic, there are more and more people falling into poverty. You know, I'm on the State Coordinating Committee for the Poor People's Campaign, which is led at a national level by Dr. William Barber and Dr. Liz Steele Harris, is a continuation of the movement that King started in the late 60s. And we talked about, King talked about three evils. They were racism, militarism, and poverty. And we've added those three evils to make them five: ecological devastation and the false narrative of Christian nationalism. And all of these things are intertwined. Right. And so the racism is nothing new. Poverty is nothing new. What we're seeing now with the pandemic is how much more people of color are impacted when there's a health crisis like this, and how much more people are who are in poverty of any race is impacted by a crisis like this. So all of this is intertwined in ways that make them very difficult to sort of solve.
If we're thinking about a way to move forward out of this, one of the things that occurs to me from looking over the body of work that you've produced is some of the stuff you've written about education.
Mm-hmm.
You described sort of this dialectic of education, which includes repressive education and emancipatory education. And on the repressive side, a lot of that is shaped by capitalist imperatives. In other words, there are realities in our, you know, systemic and institutional realities that create this repression in your descriptions there. Will this emancipatory education be part of the way forward?
Yeah, I think it will be. What I mean by emancipatory education is the kind of education that's not simply designed to produce a skill set so you can contribute to the capitalist system, but it's the kind of education that's designed to cultivate oneself as a member of a larger community, right? And part of that education would require learning more about other people. I mean, I think about when I learned U.S. history as a child, and even now, I guess, U.S. history is really a history of white male conquest. And, you know, we have this pretty narrative of this great country that came into being through the works of these great figures, but there's an undercurrent that's never talked about. And when you talk about slavery in these history books, slavery is sort of like mentioned in passing, or it's a footnote, or maybe a short chapter dedicated to it, like it's this incidental thing that took place. And there's no discussion of how deep the racism that comes out of slavery is in our country. So we really don't deal with who we are as people in our educational system. And so there's no cultivation of the self. There's no preparation for us to become members of a community.
In this emancipatory education, in this case, you know, we're not talking about liberal arts colleges or something. This is something that would be from the get-go.
The get-go, yes. Think about how different people would think if from the early days of education, they read along with whatever they're reading in literature or American history, if they read the memoirs of Native Americans or the biographies, autobiographies of slaves or people like that, the disenfranchised, the marginalized. It'll give you a totally different view of the country and a totally different view of other people whom you have to engage with on a regular basis, right? So we think differently about ourselves and think differently about each other.
Thinking about, you know, moving forward in ways that we might change systems that we have, one of the themes in your work is you'll take something that's out of fashion, a thinker or a philosopher that is maybe even old-fashioned, very problematic in some ways, and find the worthwhile part of that to save. And that's been a theme in several things that you've done. Thinking about our situation now in this pandemic, are there things like that that you would look back and say, yes, this is part of this repressive system. However, this is part that we can pull forward. This is where we can find some common ground, perhaps.
Yes. Part of what I do, and I thank you for acknowledging that, is I think even in academia, right, among academics, there's what I call a fashion parade where certain theories just come in and out of fashion. So everybody jump on the new bandwagon, the new thing, and we prematurely put great thinkers back on the shelf, right? And the task is to sort of go back and look and read them seriously and see what's there that can be put to use for us today. And you find, I mean, you'll be amazed what you find. And some of these thinkers who've been put back on the shelf, like Herbert Marcuse, whom I do quite a bit of work with, but they had insights that are very relevant for today. In terms of this pandemic, of course, since none of the thinkers I study I guess Marcuse, they did live through the pandemic of 1918, 1919. But they lived through all kinds of crises and reflected on those in a way that I think would be helpful for us today. And one of the things that Marcuse was very concerned about was, like King and the people in the Poor People's Campaign today, is the issue of poverty, that people can work and they can toil and labor and just make enough money to go back to work the next day, but never enough to guarantee that they have the resources for self-development and self-determination. And this is the place that we're in prior to the pandemic. And the pandemic comes along, and everybody, you have so many Americans, at least half, in poverty or low income, and people living from check to check and without proper medical care, and they're simply not ready for something like this. I mean, things would be a lot better for us if people were making living wages prior to the pandemic and had proper health care prior to the pandemic. The pandemic wouldn't be so devastating. But it's as devastating as it is because of prior conditions that we were living in.
Let's talk just a second then about how we move forward to the future. One of the things about your career is that you are an academic and you have your professional life in the academy. But you've also stepped out of that in numerous ways, through a political action or in involvement in the political system. If you were to advise people on what we might do to emerge from all of this in a better place than we started, what would you advise?
Well, the first thing I would advise is to forget about being comfortable for a while. And what I mean by that is we all tell ourselves stories about life. We tell ourselves stories about ourselves, about our nation, that make us feel comfortable. And quite often, those stories do not capture the entire truth. And we need to be willing to be uncomfortable in our identities for a moment, uncomfortable enough to really listen to other people who are different. Right? So part of the narrative that we have about ourselves is a narrative that sort of defines other people in a way that those people probably are not in reality. And so it really takes, to have a democratic society, you got to have democratic discourse, right? Democratic conversations. And we haven't yet had that. I get invited to a lot of places to speak, to give lectures on race and racism. And one of the first things I do when I stand before the audience is I ask them to forgive me, and then I forgive them. And, of course, people at that time are looking at me like I'm crazy because why am I forgiving them or why am I asking forgiveness? We've not done anything. And the reason I do that is because I tell them, I explain it to them, that we're about to talk about a topic that's very difficult to talk about. And it's a topic that we haven't learned to talk about because we've been in denial about it. And when we try to talk about it, if the conversation starts getting deep, the deeper it gets, the more it hurts, then we back off.
Yeah.
And we need to create a space where it's safe to talk about this topic. It's safe to feel a little bit of pain. It's safe to raise a question that you might think is a stupid question, but you have to raise it. Otherwise, you won't know the answer. So in other words, it takes a little bit of self-deconstruction, right? And so one has to deconstruct oneself to undo what has been made of oneself by a repressive and oppressive society.
University of Kentucky professor of philosophy Arnold Farr with Chris Begley, host of our ongoing series, Future Tense. Coming up after the break, what goes on behind the scenes when it comes to the management of the spaces where people gather, offices, restaurants, retail shops, manufacturing sites? We'll get some answers from Bob Cole. He manages some of Lexington's best-known commercial properties.
We're trying to learn as we go here and do what we think is the best way to, you know, to combat this pandemic and to stop it in its tracks.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
How do you go about property management in a pandemic? Retail spaces, offices, industrial structures, investment properties. What challenges are business tenants facing as they attempt to reopen in the midst of an as yet unchecked coronavirus pandemic? How are retail and office spaces now being re-engineered to account for social distancing while continuing to accommodate the need to get the work done? For insight on these matters and more, I pose some questions to Bob Cole. He is president and principal broker at Coleman Group in Lexington. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate being on the call.
And if you would, just give us a nutshell version of what your business does.
Yes, I am the president of Coleman Group Property Services. We specialize in property management, brokerage, leasing, and consulting services around commercial real estate.
And what are some businesses, some maybe high-profile brands of businesses who occupy properties that you manage?
Sure. We have worked with groups like Kroger and Ace Hardware, Dollar Tree, you know, companies like that, you know, basically any type of neighborhood shopping center on the retail front. And then on the office front, you know, we have all kinds of national scope tenants in both suburban and central business district office properties, everything from U.S. attorneys and the Kentucky League of Cities to some of our suburban assets where we have large regional and even national companies, law firms, engineering firms, things of that nature.
And so what are your responsibilities as a property manager?
Sure. We are responsible for the day-to-day operations and maintenance of the assets that we manage and lease. And these properties typically are owned by parties that are, as we refer to as third parties, that are either institutions that have invested in our community, private family trusts, things of that nature that have invested in our community. And so they hire groups like Coleman Group to be responsible for the day-to-day janitorial services, to collect rents, to hire the vendors who maintain our landscaping, HVAC, ventilation, all the things associated that you might expect to keep a property in tip-top shape and operating in its best capacity.
So where do your responsibilities as property manager end and the tenant's responsibilities begin?
The properties are managed in the accordance with a legal document called a lease. A lease is put in place, and that lease is entered into by both the ownership of the property as well as the tenant that is occupying it, whether it be a retail tenant or an office tenant. That lease will dictate the responsibilities of both parties. As a property manager, we typically, on an office scale, will be responsible for everything outside of the space that the tenant occupies. So to think of it, when you walk into an office building and you walk through the doors of that common area, that lobby, that becomes the responsibility of the landlord. But once you walk into the tenant space, for the most part, the tenant then becomes responsible for the interior space itself. On a retail basis, the landlord is responsible for the exterior, which would encompass the roof and the front sidewalks and things of that nature. But again, the interior would be the responsibility of the tenant. Now, all, you know, not with a broad stroke brush, but, you know, not all things are equal. Every lease has been negotiated and as does vary. I can use terms like, you know, general, and this is typically how it's handled, but you must refer to the actual legal document to dictate whose responsibility is what when it comes to property management and maintenance.
Okay, we got a good orientation there. So let's talk pandemic. This thing hit out of the blue. It didn't come with an instruction manual. And so what I'd like to do is take a quick look at your world sector by sector, if we could, with retail first. And what percentage of your retail clients are still operable, would you say?
Yes. When the pandemic hit, and we'll use mid-March as kind of the point where the governor mandated a shelter-in-place policy that essentially at that point made it difficult for a large percentage of retail tenants to continue doing business. In a neighborhood shopping center, and as you've even seen in the open-air centers and malls, that ended up being about 40% of the tenants could remain in business and actually be considered essential, like medical users, some of the hardware stores, dollar stores, things of that nature. What was hardest hit was, obviously, as we've now seen in the news, are the restaurants, the hair salons, nail salons, the fitness centers, all of those essentially through the social distancing guidelines and guidelines not only established by each municipality and by the governor, but also by the CDC and a lot of the outlines that they put in place for best practices. So to answer your question, between 40 and 50% of the shopping centers were essentially shut down at that point in time.
How have the landlords been about this? Have they been, for the most part, willing to work with people?
Yes, you know, as you said earlier, you know, there was no roadmap, there was no instruction manual that came with an event like this pandemic. I would like to say that the industry that we work in is well educated. A lot of folks came together and started communicating almost immediately, trying to learn from one another on how we would work with our tenants in this scenario. It became clear that there was going to need to be some give and take on both parties, by both parties. In other words, you know, the tenants needed our help, and we still had obligations to, you know, maintain and take care of the property as the leases dictated to us. Their obligation was to pay rent to us as the lease dictated by them. But we all understood that we needed to get to the other side of this thing, and no one knew how long it would take. To that end, the bank stepped in. And the best way to describe it is we worked with our tenants, as most reasonable landlords did, to forego rents in some form of deferment, whether that be putting the amount that was owed over a greater period of time, spread it over the remaining lease term, put it on the back end of the lease. There were lots of different ways, and each tenant was worked with individually depending on the needs that they might have. We then saw immediately communication with lenders coming to us before we could even go to them and saying, hey, we know this is going to happen to you. What do you need from us to help you as the borrower get to the other side? And so it was incredibly humbling to me that everyone worked together to survive this. And so even those tenants that continued to operate in the center, you know, they still needed their property managers to keep the property up, to protect them even more so than ever, to do what we could to try to stop the spread of this pandemic, and at the same token, live up to the responsibilities that our leases dictate.
So local banks stepped up.
They did. They did. We saw regional banks, local banks really coming to the forefront with ideas of how to defer the owner's mortgage payments for anywhere from 3 to 6 months. In some instances, those were complete forbearance agreements where we didn't have to make complete principal and interest payments. In some instances, it was where only interest was deferred. But nevertheless, it was enough for us to allow owners to pass on to the tenants the rent relief that they needed. And clearly, you know, as I said, we didn't know how long this was going to go on. We felt like that, you know, based on other countries, that this was probably a 3 to 4 month type cycle, but that everybody understood it was fluid and that we'd be looking at it as we moved forward, and we'd make decisions that hopefully was in the best interest of all parties.
Well, restaurants and a lot of other businesses, for that matter, have tried morphing into delivery and curbside pickup. How has that been working for your tenants that you manage?
Yes, absolutely. The restaurants and some of them immediately jumped on the bandwagon, although we do not manage any centers currently that has Bluegrass Hospitalities. Many people know that as Malone's. They've done a fantastic job of you know, working through the curbside delivery. I think this is a component that's not just going to be a pandemic driven utility, but I think we're going to see more and more of this because I think we've learned, both the consumer and the retailer have learned, you know, some of the benefits to this style of operation. So definitely they readjusted their business model to impact how they were going to, if you will, continue to operate. Some businesses, they had no operating strategy or plan. You know, a fitness center, just by nature of its being, could not continue to do any type of, you know, adjustment that would help their business. Although some tried the virtual, and we've seen some companies in town like Burn Boot Camp that did a fantastic job with the virtual training sessions and so forth. For the most part, you know, even the restaurants, you know, they can't operate with essentially a reduced capacity of volume and still turn a profit. It's very, very hard when a lot of their business comes from the set down, the liquor sales, things of that nature. We saw it, but the verdict is out, you know, on whether that's going to be a successful model going forward, but one that looks like it is going to be around for some time.
Okay, let's turn to office spaces. I know the vacancy rate had been trending steadily downward beginning at about 2014. What's it look like now?
Yeah, we've had a really strong economy, specifically in Lexington, for the last 2 or 3 years. And when you look at the national standards, Lexington has always fared well. There's great reports out there that show the vacancy was decreasing in both the urban setting, being the central business district downtown, as well as the suburban market. Construction had not been, there hadn't been overbuilding. And so we were starting to see business growth that was absorbing space, and it was very positive. 2020 was a record year for most property owners as it related to building occupancy. We all of a sudden saw the brakes completely come on in March with the pandemic. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what that looks like going forward with social distancing, with the work from home philosophies, the Zoom meetings that everyone's doing. You know, a lot of discussion is, has that changed office such that, it, you know, is it dead? Is office space no longer going to be a viable commodity? And I believe that the indication is that there will be some shift and that you'll see some of the work from home strategies done to benefit the brick and mortar office location. However, we do believe that there is going to be some dynamics and there's going to be some shifts where we'll see more absorption potentially in the suburbs than maybe in the central business district because of a pandemic attacking a highly dense area where there's a large congregation of people and so forth, whereas in the suburbs, you know, they can shelter a little bit easier. They're not as exposed to the type of movement that they have in a downtown area. So we do anticipate that absorption is going to be effective in the short run, to call it the 12 to 24 month period, where we're probably going to have negative absorption or very flat. But we do anticipate that that growth will occur again. And we're actually starting to get inquiries, leasing calls to occur. But again, the majority of those calls are inquiries of suburban space.
When offices do reopen and there is a return, somewhat of a return, I imagine some people will remain working at home. Others will be returning. What do you think those offices are going to look and feel like, Bob?
Yes. Social distancing now, as we know it, is the single best way to stop this pandemic. You know, obviously wearing the mask, the sanitation, the cleaning that goes into, you know, trying to protect the workers, that's extremely important. But I also think that you have to look at the divide of what we've learned in this pandemic and that working from home is possible. And that there are a lot of situations where, quite frankly, it probably makes sense to have a certain percentage of your workforce working from home, especially to prepare in the event that we should have this outbreak continue to spike again, another pandemic. I think prudency says that you need to be prepared to run your organizations remotely. I think that some of the things that we're talking about as a landlord have a lot to do with making sure that the tenants understand that that remote workforce also has some concerns for the employee. You know, the employee now working from their home is distanced from other members of their group, and that the best work is collaboration and is done typically in group settings and in person. So as much as it sounds great to think that we're going to be working remotely on a computer, I worry about the health of the employee. I know I do for my folks, and I realize that the most important thing that we can do and have done in the pandemic is to protect these employees, and we need to think about that going forward from a mental health capacity and just making sure that we give every opportunity for these employees to be their best self.
You know, in preparing for this interview, I started thinking about all the things that are involved in managing a building, and there's a lot that goes on there, I think, that we just take for granted and don't really notice, but now, wipe-down protocols become important. Thinking about ingress and egress, stairwells, elevators. How are you approaching those issues?
We have immediately, not only with the pandemic, but now with the reentry, we have attempted to establish procedures whereby as the employees or the visitors to the space come into the building, we have posted directory signage for them. And again, we're not you know, policing as much as, you know, asking for these invitees and for the tenants to wear their mask. We have placed hand sanitizers on all floors. We have asked that the elevator use be limited to two people per ride. We've asked that employees and invitees use the stairwells if at all possible. We have set up standards where on-site maintenance staff are now cleaning the high touch points areas of the elevators and the bathrooms. So we're giving a lot more attention to the janitorial needs of a property. We're also following CDC guidelines with respect to techniques like Dwell, where when you spray the application a cleaning product onto a surface, that you allow it to set for 3 to 4 minutes before wiping. And all of those components really focus on the core and common area of where people travel and walk to, and the restrooms and so forth. The interior of the space becomes the responsibility of the tenant. They're needing to take care of the desk and the phones and the computers and things of that nature. Again, we're trying to limit the contact and as the people that are going into a space. We do still have janitorial services at night, and those services have been increased to pick up cleaning protocols as recommended in the break rooms and conference rooms and so forth. We're trying to learn as we go here and do what we think is the best way to, you know, to combat this pandemic and to stop it in its tracks.
Bob Cole is president and principal broker at Coleman Group in Lexington. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciated the opportunity.
Next week on Eastern Standard, one day in the near future, we'll be talking again about starting businesses, creating jobs, and growing our economy. We're going to launch another new series focusing on the direct connection between entrepreneurial economic development and education. It will be hosted by former University of Kentucky President Lee Todd, his first guest, Space Tango co-founder Chris Kimmel. We'll talk psychology and mental health with a man who knows the territory, Robert Brubaker, chair of the EKU Department of Psychology. He's retiring. Find out why people call him Pierre. And what do you know about Stinking Creek and how it got that name? We'll get the story from Catherine Engel of the Appalachian Center and Appalachian Studies Program at UK. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.